Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Elizabeth Greenwood was feeling overwhelmed. After quitting her job teaching in a Bronx public school, she was back in school with a new student loan piled onto a mound of undergraduate debt. She was sharing her fantasy of escaping to Belize when a friend joked that she should just fake her death. That got her thinking, and then fairly obsessed with how and why people commit suicide, the ultimate ticket to a fresh start. Elizabeth discovered a global disappearance industry that plots, facilitates, and documents fraudulent deaths. She spoke to people who tried to pull it off and investigators who tracked them down, and to those left behind to pick up the pieces. Her new book, Playing Dead, A Journey Through the World of Death Fraud, plunges into the mechanics and desperation that make ending a life appear to be an act of survival. Elizabeth Greenwood, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it used to be pretty easy to fake a death a century ago. You found that people could just place an obituary in the paper. Or in the fictional world, we have Dick Whitman, who became Don Draper in the show Mad Men, by switching dog tags. How about today, with our long digital trails? Is it still possible?
That's exactly right about the obituaries. The funny thing is that today, people still will send in their own obituaries. There's one case after September 11th of a man named Stephen Leung, who phoned in his own obituary posing as a non-existent brother, because he was living as an undocumented immigrant on expired passport here in the States. And he was hoping to just kind of end that life so that he could actually stay and resume pretty much doing what he was doing, just without the legal trouble. So people still actually place obituaries today. Kind of funny to think about. Seems so analog. But today, the thing about faking your death, it's kind of paradoxical. The people who fake their deaths successfully, we never know about because they're just assumed dead. So the information we can glean from cases that have gone wrong suggests that it is still possible to fake your death, but it just takes a lot of very conscientious planning, a lot of really staying off the grid and trying to evade the digital trail and footprint that we all leave every time we swipe a credit card or use our cell phones. So it is possible. It's just mighty difficult.
Well, you did talk to a number of people who did fail, but people who were desperate enough to fake their death, like the hedge fund manager slash Ponzi schemer Sam Israel. Now, he was facing 22 years in prison when he faked his own suicide. So what was his scheme?
So Sam Israel had lost, at this point, $500 million of investor money in a Ponzi scheme. There's actually a great book written just about Sam Israel called Octopus, and that's by Yee Lawson. And that gets into a lot of the background on Sam, because Sam faking his death is actually one of the least crazy things that happened in his whole kind of career. So I highly recommend that book for more on Sam. But for Sam's suicide, what he did is that over the course of a few weeks prior to staging his suicide off the Bear Mountain Bridge in New York State in June of 2008, he went about acquiring IDs, different kinds of permits and documents, and for a man by the name of David Clapp, who had died years prior. Sam's accident that he staged was to drive to the Bear Mountain Bridge and make it look like he was just another kind of defamed Wall Streeter who was ending his life after getting into some serious hot water with the law. So he stepped actually to the edge of the bridge and jumped. He actually did jump. He made it look like he was committing a suicide. He actually managed to catch himself in construction nets that had been hung below the bridge to catch falling debris and rocks. And then hand over hand, he managed to wriggle himself to the other side of the river and scramble up an embankment and then hop in his getaway RV, which he had with the help of a young man that he had parked on the other side of the river. And he took off and he lived in campsites for a few weeks before ultimately turning himself in. And in that time that he was on the run, he actually saw his own face on America's Most Wanted.
Mm. And he paid a young cousin to help him. But there are people in the quote-unquote disappearance industry to help
right.
people fake their suicides. Now, first, was it easy to find a disappearance expert?
Well, there's a slight distinction to make between disappearing and faking a suicide. So the people that I spoke with, namely Frank Ahern, he's a privacy consultant, quote unquote, and he helps people disappear. And he helps people disappear in the physical realm of, you know, leaving your life behind and also trying to minimize the digital footprint you can leave online. So Sam never helped anyone stage their own death, but he did help people leave their lives behind. And he actually works quite out in the open. He's the author of a best-selling book called How to Disappear. And he's very public in what he does because he does he doesn't break any laws necessarily in doing the work to help people disappear.
Now, you've led to a couple things. One, I noticed that mm-hmm. Frank's book mm-hmm. sells well over 150 mm-hmm. copies a week online. So how much does he charge to help a person disappear?
So when he would help a client disappear, he would charge up to in the neighborhood of $30,000. And the people he would charge were typically, by his account, they were usually middle-aged men who were in search of what he called the palm tree lifestyle. So guys who had either come into a lot of money or maybe lost a lot of money and just wanted to leave it all behind. They just wanted to, you know, maybe just live as an expatriate in Central America rather cheaply. The women that Frank helped disappear were usually women who contacted him because they were in domestic violence relationships or they were trying to evade a stalker. Their lives were usually really, very much at risk. And for those women, Frank wouldn't charge anything.
You said what Frank is doing is not illegal. That was one of the surprising things I learned in mm-hmm. your book. It is not illegal to fake your own death.
That's exactly right. There's no crime called faking your own death. When Sam got caught, when he gave himself up when he was on the run, he had 2 years added to his sentence for obstruction of justice because, you know, he was supposed to be turning himself in to jail at the time. But there's no law called faking your own death. The ancillary crimes related with faking your death will get you in trouble, such as identity theft, life insurance fraud. Those are very much illegal. But there is this very kind of narrow space that you could occupy where you could have people think you're dead and not commit any other crimes.
Well, you also met a lot of people who are trying to track those kind of cases down. Joe Crochet, who works with the NYPD, and Steve Rombon, who's hired as an insurance fraud investigator. Any idea of how many cases they follow each year?
Well, Joe Crochet was an NYPD detective who was on a squad that became known as Operation Vulture Sweep after September 11th. He and several other detectives were in charge of sussing out different kinds of frauds that people brought in the wake of the terrorist attacks, claiming that they had a loved one who had passed, who did not exist, and they collected, you know, in many cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars from charities. So Joe Crochet on Operation Vulture Sweep, they identified 44 cases of fraud in the wake of the terrorist attacks. Steve is an elite private investigator. A big part of his business is life insurance fraud investigation, but he does do other investigative work. And his specialty is tracking down missing persons. So for the life insurance fraud portion of Steve's business, he typically does dozens a year. And again, these are very specific cases where the policy that the claimant has taken out is over a certain dollar threshold, usually in the millions, because he charges in the neighborhood of $1,500 a day when he's overseas investigating these frauds. Mm. So there are other, you know, life insurance frauds that happen that are for lower dollar amounts where Steve might not get called in just because it's so pricey for the company.
And in fact, Frank, I believe, tells you that the less money a person has, the easier it is to make them disappear. Is money?
That's exactly right.
Is money usually the motivation?
Money typically is a motivation, either having lost it a lot of times and finding yourself in very steep debts. Sometimes it's having come into a lot of money. And in the words of Frank, he says, you know, trying to avoid the ex-wife sucking him dry. So that's sometimes a consideration. And then in terms of death frauds that are committed to collect a life insurance policy, those pseudosides are an attempt to gain money.
So if Frank were advising someone like Sam, I know Sam faked his death, how would he advise him to disappear, do you think?
I think that Frank would have told Sam to just skip the whole suicide attempt in general, because already it doesn't look believable. Sam was wanted by numerous law enforcement, security exchange committees. So already it just looks a little suspicious. Frank's whole ethos is that the kind of less complicated you can make disappearing, the better. The thing that he always says about fake deaths is that there's always just one variable you're never going to be able to imagine. And that's really where people get tripped up.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and you're listening to Word of Mouth and our conversation with Elizabeth Greenwood, author of Playing Dead, A Journey Through the World of Death Fraud. One of the lessons I learned reading her book is that insurance fraud is almost certain to get you caught, especially if you have a large life insurance policy. I asked Elizabeth about some of the other red flags that might tip off investigators.
One red flag that really surprised me is that water accidents, drowning, falling off a fishing boat, for example, those definitely raise red flags for law enforcement and investigators. I think that lay people have this conception of, okay, well, if you're going to fake your death, you have this onus of providing a body. So what's a scenario that could eliminate that? And we all think, oh, go for a swim, drown, no big deal. In reality, most bodies from a drowning do end up being recovered eventually. If not in the first few days, then a few weeks down the road. So it's very suspicious for there to be a water accident with no drowning.
So what might be a better idea?
So, again, you know, this was the thing that a lot of the experts kept coming back to me with that really surprised me, was just making the accident as elegant and simple and less complicated, the better. So going for a hike, for example, and just never coming back, that is unfortunately a way that a lot of people do meet their ends, but it's not as kind of narratively concrete as person went swimming, therefore they drowned. Hiking is probably a good way to go.
Well, that makes me so creeped out about all the people go missing.
I know. Especially you all are in New Hampshire. Jeez. I know.
Well, you mentioned the water, and I couldn't help think of a case that you wrote about, Patrick McDermott. Now, this was an Australian singer, one-time boyfriend of Olivia Newton-John. So given the whiff of celebrity connection, I guess Dateline got in on his case. What did they find?
So Patrick McDermott had recently filed for bankruptcy and was experiencing, I believe, some back child support issues. So he was already in a little bit of hot water financially. He staged a boating accident off the coast of Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. And investigators from Dateline NBC were hired to go find him. And the way they found him is because they set up a site, a website, dedicated to locating Patrick McDermott, like a tip line sort of thing, if you have any information, et cetera, et cetera. So what they discovered when they were looking at the IP addresses from where people were logging on from is that there was this centralized cluster in Mexico of computers that were logging onto this website. So they basically just followed that trail, and lo and behold, there was McDermott. He kept logging on to the site, trying to kind of trace where his pursuers were, what kind of information they were getting, and he ended up just leading them right to his hideout.
So lesson number, what, I don't know which number this is, but don't Google stalk yourself after.
Don't Google yourself.
Well, you know, we're saying that this is, I'm laughing about this because there are so many cases in here that it just makes you, you know, smite your forehead and just think, what were they thinking? But, you know, it's a dark and macabre subject. It doesn't seem like that's how you experienced it, is it?
Well, I think there is something kind of inherently slapstick funny about faking your own death. I mean, death, a lot of philosophers believe, is the ultimate absurdity. So what could be more absurd than trying to, you know, take the upper hand with that and try to kind of manipulate your own mortality? It just seems so ridiculous in a lot of ways that you think you could do this and really get away with it. And then the people I met, I think I was expecting to meet these kind of shadowy figures who, you know, kind of skulked around the periphery of society. But really, in fact, you know, Frank and Steve and, you know, even people I met who had faked their deaths were very kind and generous and warm. So I didn't find that darkness so much. The one place I did find, you know, a bit of the real sadness was in talking with family members who had a loved one who had faked their death. And either they were implicated in the crime, and for example, helping a father try to claim life insurance, and then a son ends up serving jail time right along with his father, or people who had thought that their parent had been dead their entire lives, and then lo and behold, you know, decades later, they find out that that person was actually alive. So that was oft very troubling and sad.
Well, one pretty dark place you did get to was you went down to the Philippines to fake your own death or to experiment with what that would mean. There is, I guess, a cottage industry in some developing countries like the Philippines in generating death certificates or death kits. What goes in a death kit?
A death kit is basically all the documents you would need to present to a life insurance company to verify your death and try to claim insurance. So you have a death certificate, you have a burial permit, a coroner's report, you have a doctor's testimony, witness testimony, police reports, all the different elements that would go into creating a death on paper.
Well, you've kind of ruined it for yourself, haven't you, Elizabeth? I mean, all a student loan debt collector has to do is Google you, find your book, and your cover's kind of blown.
Unfortunately. Well, the thing that I discovered when writing this book and reporting this book is that I had initially come to the idea because of my own student loan debt, like many, many Americans. I'm kind of carrying this albatross. And I'd felt so oppressed by it. But then meeting people, you know, like Sam Israel or others in the book who did, in fact, go through staging their own deaths, the stakes to actually go through with this have to be just so much higher and so much more urgent than student loan debt, than a little bit of measly, you know, six-figure student loan debt. No big deal. So it kind of cast my own financial plight into a starker relief.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you for speaking with us and really glad you made it through.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Elizabeth Greenwood teaches in Columbia's Creative Writing Program and is the author of Playing Dead, A Journey Through the World of Death Fraud. There's more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.